Welcome to our virtual series, Conversations with CEOs. I'm Warren Zola, the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. As one of the top CEO speaking forums in the world, the Boston College Chief Executives Club gathers Boston's top business leaders several times each year. For this session, we hosted three CEOs who, in addition to promoting diversity and inclusion within the organizations, are members of PwC's CEO Action for Diversity and Inclusion Initiative. Our panel discussion included Jenny Johnson, President and CEO of Franklin Templeton, Wright Lasseter III, President and CEO of the Henry Ford Health System, and Tim Ryan, U.S. Chairman and Senior Partner of PwC. In our conversation, we discussed how the pandemic and racial tensions of the past year have highlighted the importance of diversity and inclusion, both in society, but also in leading large organizations. Best practices, crisis management, and the importance of listening to your employees are all topics that are covered during this roundtable. Today, I'm especially excited to host three CEOs, each of whom are leading an organization dedicated to diversity and inclusion, so much so that they're part of PwC's CEO Action for Diversity and Inclusion Initiative. Our panel today includes Jenny Johnson, President and CEO of Franklin Templeton, Wright Lasseter III, President and CEO of the Henry Ford Health System, and Tim Ryan, U.S. Chairman and Senior Partner of PwC. We're thrilled to have so many of our members join us, especially my Board of Governors. Thank you for your time out of your busy schedules to join us today for this important topic. As always, we will have a panel discussion, we will open up to member questions, and then at the top of the hour, we'll end the conversation and we'll go to a lightning round of questions, and we will have our prompt adjournment, as promised to everybody, at 1:15. So let's get this started. And I'm going to get going, Tim, with you. In July of 2016, just 5 days into your role as CEO, a series of violent and racially motivated incidents took place in this country and changed things for you and for all of us. You realized you had a bigger mission at PwC than just increasing revenue. And in just a short few weeks, you and your team pivoted your strategy and shut down the company for a day to hold a day-long company-wide conversation on race all across the country. What was that period of time like, and how did that conversation go, and what did you learn from it as a CEO and as a leader?
Yeah, thank you, Warren, and to all of your guests. It's great to be with you today. I hope you're doing well, and thank you for carving out an hour and 15 minutes of your time for such an important topic. Warren, as you noted, in the first week of July 2016, we had shootings in Dallas, and that was in the heels of violence in Minneapolis and Louisiana. At the time, I had just become our senior partner, which is our vernacular for CEO. And it became very clear listening to our people that we were not comfortable at work talking about such a delicate for many, such a difficult for many, but yet such an important topic. So we made the decision in 2.5 weeks to shut the firm down for a day on July 21, 2016. And we're about 55,000 people. So you don't take a decision to shut down an organization lightly for 55,000 people, and certainly in 2.5 weeks. Leading up to that, it was concerning, right? It was many of my advisors were for it, and many of my advisors were against it. They felt that it might be risky. The discussions might go off the guardrails. We might say the wrong thing. It could hurt the brand. We could actually have a good deed turn into a bad deed and then have it blow up in our face. We ended up deciding that if we were serious, like really serious about driving inclusion further, that we needed to do it. And so we had that day on July 21, 2016, and all across the country, we held discussions about the topic of race and what it was like to be Black in the workplace, what it was like to be Black outside of the workplace, and what how you brought that into the workplace and how you related to other people. And the discussions went great all across the country. It went amazing. I spent that day partly in Atlanta and partly in New York. In Atlanta, I learned from our Black professionals that they carried their PwC business card with them. So if they got pulled over, they could show the officer that they could afford the car and that they didn't steal it. I learned in New York that some of our Black professionals, when they took their suit and tie off and they were walking down 6th Ave, to go to a softball game in Central Park, they felt unsafe. They went from feeling safe inside the four walls of PwC to 300 yards out the door going to Central Park, and they felt unsafe. Things I could have never understood, and more importantly, we could have never understood. So it was an eye-opening day. One of our people summed it up best. They said to me that we shed more tears on that day than we did in our 160-year history. And I believe that's true. And for us, the lesson learned was the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again. We had two decades in back of us of progress. We had two decades of programs, two decades of a lot of activity, but we missed the heart. I thought we missed the heart. We missed understanding what our coworkers, our friends, and our colleagues were living with every day. And it taught me a really important lesson. As a CEO, you've got to trust your gut. You've got to be willing to take risk, because without risk, you're not going to get a different answer or a great different outcome. And I have no regrets whatsoever about doing that. And now for us, it's become cultural. 4 years later, it's something that happens as a matter of regular course at PwC.
And that's fantastic. I mean, not necessarily all of the implications of learning, but the fact that you went as a new CEO and you not only said we have to do something, but you actually took action instead of just spoke about it. And clearly this bleeds into the initiative that PwC has launched. And then we'll get into Jenny and Wright, why it was so important for them and their companies to join along with so many others. But in 2017, you launched the CEO Action for Diversity and Inclusion Initiative. You must have learned from the 2016 day of discussions and decided not only did you want to play a leadership role at PwC, but broader. So you can tell us a little bit about what you're trying to accomplish in this initiative, and then we'll turn to Jenny and Wright and ask them why it was so important for them to join this initiative.
Yeah, thanks, Warren, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about CEO Action. So just a quick story. So that day, July 21, 2016, I was leaving the New York office at about 8 o'clock at night, and I was in our lobby of 300 Madison. And one of our Black professionals who was a manager, so think 6 years of experience with us, he came up to me and he said, Tim, he said, really, really good day. Thank you. And I thought he was going to be done. And then when he said, but what's your role outside of PwC? We have 20,000 clients. We have a big brand. What's our role outside the four walls? And I will admit, Warren, and for your listeners, at the time when he said that to me, I was like, oh my God, can I have a break? Like, we just had this day. It didn't blow up. It went great. But that night I tossed and turned the entire night. I tossed and turned because he was right. Like, he was right. And we have this wonderful privilege of working with great leaders like Jenny and Wright and so many others. And it led me to reach out to fellow CEOs. So I got connected with David Taylor at Procter & Gamble. Yep. I got connected with Ron Parker, who was, at the time was the CEO of the Executive Leadership Council. And the three of us, with the help of many others, we asked ourselves, what can we do to help make not only ourselves, but the business community better? Because unfortunately, we knew these challenges were going to get more and more. And if we don't break through, we'll never get the full potential we're looking for. So what the goal is and what we decided is, the idea here is that none of us are perfect. None of us are perfect. And we all have the opportunity to make each other better. We decided fundamentally that diversity and inclusion should not be a competitive issue. It should be the single biggest opportunity we have to make our society better. If we make our society inclusive, we then have the ability to have a booming economy and we can feel really good about what we're doing. So we decided we were going to ask companies to commit to four basic things. And the four basic things were, number one, make the workplaces truly safe to talk about the issues around diversity, inclusion, race, and other important elements, Asian American, Pacific Islanders, gender, and a number of other elements. Make it truly safe to talk about it. The second one was to make unconscious bias training available to everybody, not just the executive suite. So I have a Boston audience here. We have worked with Dr. Banaji at Harvard for over 10 years, and she has helped us study the science behind unconscious biases, how we're grown up, and we learn these through childhood and adulthood. And so we asked every company to make unconscious bias training available to everybody. We also asked every company to commit to having an annual diversity and inclusion strategic plan, something that is reviewed at least once with the board that covers talent attraction, recruitment, advancement, pay equity, supplier equity, representation at all levels, and transparency and the role of transparency. And then we also lastly asked every company to share best practices. because we shouldn't all be investing over and over and again. When PwC makes a mistake, somebody else should benefit from it. When something happens great at Procter & Gamble, we should all be able to learn from that. So those are the four basic commitments we ask every company to make. And we asked everybody to do it at the CEO level, the branding, which Procter & Gamble was very helpful in, CEO and action. So it starts at the CEO level and taking action a bit more into your point. And so we launched with 112 companies on June 12, 2017. And today we're at over 2,000 CEOs who have made those commitments and are bringing those to life every day.
That's fantastic. And I also, I should do a side note here. We were fortunate to have a conversation with David Taylor, unfortunately, in person, got canceled. He joined us in the fall. And I can't think of a CEO that I would turn to before him to discuss diversity and inclusion across all facets to understand. And I think that's great. So Jenny, I'll turn to you first and then right, we'll go to you. Jenny, when you heard about the CEO action, what was it that attracted you and Franklin Templeton? Why was it so important for you guys to join up? Because clearly it is.
Well, I mean, I think we have to also think about this as, I always think of D&I as a real growth story, right? So if you just believe, you have the issue around social equality, right? People, equal access, equal opportunity, those types of things, right? So that's important for society. But if you think about it in a business, if you believe that people have biases, which we do, and I think there's a lot of science around that, then chances are you're overlooking great candidates to bring onto your team. So unless you do training, you're not going to get access to those candidates. The same thing we think in the investment business. You know, I always say that with now 2% of venture capital money going to women, boy, that's, you know, the most crowded trade is the white male entrepreneur, right? So think about the greatest opportunity is going to be other kind of diverse African-Americans get less than 1%. So we look at it both in the firm as a great opportunity to have the best talent. I jokingly say the movie Moneyball could teach us all about bias, about how you overlook, you know, people overlook, you know, he pitches sidearm or whatever, and look at the team they brought together. So, you know, if you think about it from a business standpoint, one is it just made sense to say, let's broaden our net of how we recruit and bring into our firm, and then also measure how we're retaining and creating an environment for that. So that was important to us. And then, as Tim mentioned, you know, sort of the framework of approach, it was like, well, this is a great framework. We can really help do this. And if you have an initiative with all these CEOs working together, we can actually learn from each other on experiences. You know, this is a journey that's better for everybody. And so it just made sense to say, you know, let's participate in this.
And clearly, I'm assuming that not only have you learned, but you've brought stuff to the table that the rest of the group has been able to take away from that as well, right?
Sure. In the conversations with each other, you're really trying to learn. And I know for us, you know, we just this year hired a chief diversity and inclusion officer, and she reports directly to me. You know, we meet every 2 weeks, and it so it forces the topic to be always on my agenda. I mean, let's face it, as a CEO, you got a lot of things you're worried about. Quarterly earnings, whatever, you know, sort of, you know, comes up ahead of you. And so unless you have it scheduled, you know, you're not going to keep focusing it all the time. And we think it's so important that it has to be focused all the time. And part of what she's doing is helping us create a scorecard internally so that we can measure what we do. You know, the fact is you're not going to get change unless you're able to measure it. One of the topics we just prior to this call had my executive committee. We're talking about ensuring that every employee has as part of their performance review one D&I initiative. So either it's unconscious, we already have unconscious bias training, but some additional, like with our business resource group, spending time, they've created these programs that can teach kind of what the experience is for them to work within the company, measuring our recruitment, measuring our retention, measuring our promotions. And so it's just, you know, forced us to think about it and make it part of our own scorecard as a company.
And what's great about D&I is that it's something that A, is right for society, B, it's right for business. And so the more we uncover and have these conversations, I think the more recognition across the board that there's no reason not to engage, whether it's for P&L, if it's social issues, all of the above. I mean, that Venn diagram is perfect for all of us. And so, right, welcome back. And what is it about this CEO action that moved you as you lead Henry Ford and that system towards the future to be involved in this.
Yeah, Warren, so let me just join Tim and Jenny and just one saying thanks for the opportunity and appreciate being here with you and with my colleagues. You know, I would tell you that our organization, not unlike the story that Jenny described, has spent a number of years with a focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion. You know, we had received some national attention for the work we did. And so to some extent, this wasn't new for us. But in my mind, what attracted me to the CEO Action was really a couple things. And I think Tim described, as he described the framework, what was really important to me was two things. First and foremost, a commitment of leading companies around the United States that were willing to share best practices. You know, I tell our team all the time that I have a view that when we accomplish something and get recognized for something, we should take a moment to recognize ourselves and pat ourselves on the back and then get to work and work harder and think about what we can do more. And so I honestly had a belief that, you know, while I run a large healthcare company, you know, my sense was oftentimes the healthcare industry doesn't spend as much time learning from corporate America as I think we could. And whether that's, you know, how we deal with logistics or how we deal with, you know, call centers, or in this case, how we might deal with diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so I was really excited by the notion that there were, you know, at the time that we joined in 2018, I think there were already a couple hundred CEOs that had committed. And I was anxious to be part of a cadre of folks that would share what they were doing. And my sense was, as I talked to our chief diversity officer and our senior executives and our board about how we could do better, that the best way for us to do better was very likely to keep pushing ourselves. And one of the best ways to push yourselves is to hang out with other folks who are high achievers, because oftentimes you realize that when you hang out with a bunch of stars, that you can make your star shine even brighter when you're hanging out with other stars. And so that was part of it for me. You know, I think the other issue is this. You know, Tim and I have talked on a number of occasions about his early experiences. The story he shared with you all, he has shared with me on more than one occasion. And I had, you know, a similar experience in my organization. So, you know, I'm an African-American man leading a company in a majority minority city, based in a majority minority city. I have a large percentage of people of color that work in our company, you know, 35,000 employees. And the presumption is, well, because you are a person of color, you know, you must have all the answers, you must know how to do this particular topic well, or more importantly, you really know how everyone in your organization who might look like you, you know how they think. And the short answer is I absolutely do not. And my experience is not the experience of every employee I have in the team member in our organization. And so the notion of creating safe places and safe spaces to have these kinds of conversations was also really important to me. And I realized that as I looked at the work that we had been doing and the quote unquote progress we had made in this area, we had spent almost no time on the topic of have we made it safe for people to have conversations that are uncomfortable, but can allow us to move our organization forward. And as I thought about this commitment to that, and I talked to our team about, so, you know, let's have conversations across the organization around how comfortable do people feel having uncomfortable conversations about race, about diversity, about equity, about inclusion. And if it's not comfortable, then we need to fix that. And so, you know, while unconscious bias training was an important part of it, but we were already on that journey, frankly, before PwC. So we didn't necessarily need the, you know, Tim's efforts around CEO Action to drive us to do that, because we were making that commitment already. But it was clear to me that we hadn't focused on something that I thought was a very, very basic building block to creating the best culture you can in your organization. And that's creating safety to have all the kinds of conversations that you need. You know, we focus on making it safe to have conversations around things like patient safety. And, you know, when you think about how do you create an environment with zero harm, you know, in the same respect, creating a culture that has zero harm as it relates to the psyche of your team members is just as critical as in a healthcare organization creating zero harm when you're providing, you know, high intensity surgery or whatever else you might be doing from a medical perspective. And so those were some of the things that that sort of motivated me to be part of the process.
Hey, Warren, it's Tim. Do you mind if I just jump in for a second, if that's all right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I just want to build off some right and Jenny said, for our listeners here, and I should have said, anybody is welcome to join. Wright's point around being around a lot of smart people who've tried different things, I just have to double down on that. One of the best benefits that we've had out of forming this group is none of us have all the answers. And what I've found massively benefiting is talking to really smart people like Wright and Jenny and so many others around, what did you try? What did you do? How'd you feel? How are you balancing this risk? Are the majority going to get upset? That I literally have had hundreds of one-on-one conversations with CEOs. Sometimes I'm a giver and sometimes I'm a taker, like in terms of advice, but to go on the journey, like that's what we've seen to be so powerful. And unfortunately, with all of the fastballs the world's been throwing at us over the last 4 years, it's been more important than ever, more important than ever. So any member can join. Don't miss, we're all tend to be, hey, we're CEOs of all the answers. What we found here is a group where we can talk to one another and figure out how we're balancing those has been very helpful.
And that's an absolutely perfect segue because, A, I think you've defined a little bit the mission of this organization, right? The Boston College Chief Executives Club is to bring leaders together to learn from each other, to self-pollinate these ideas, knowing that everyone's got stuff to add in and to learn, right? If you're not a lifelong learner, you're in the wrong position, in the wrong role. And you also mentioned sort of fastballs that have been coming at us. So last year and this year has certainly brought a lot of challenges to all of us. We've got COVID, we've had some terrible racial incidents. Each of you all of our members have had to navigate these challenges. So I'm going to turn to each of you to ask sort of a specific question about what you wound up doing in the past year. Wright, I'll start with you and then I'll go to Jenny and then Tim. But Wright, you know, you're leading this enormous healthcare system within the community of Detroit where you've played a leadership role. How did you respond to the racial unrest during COVID last summer?
Thanks, Warren, for the question. You know, a few things. You know, first and foremost, I think we all have been, you know, taken aback by a number of the challenges that our country has faced in the last few years, and sometimes we continue to be puzzled by why in a country that is as advanced as we are, that we still seem to have such lingering challenges. You know, honestly, I would tell you that when the issues first occurred last summer, I did something that is not the best approach for CEOs at times, because our organizations and our communities are looking for us to say something, do something, et cetera. But, you know, initially I went a bit internal because I felt like I just needed a bit of introspection, just given, you know, some of my life history, and some of my parents' life history. I didn't want to say anything or do anything, frankly. I just wanted to just be introspective because that's sort of my personality. But I also realized, you know, relatively quickly that I don't have the luxury of doing that when you're leading in the way that I'm leading and being part of a community in the way that I am. And so, you know, one of the first things that I did was, I used letter writing as a little bit of catharsis. And so I wrote a letter to our organization. And it was something that honestly I had not ever done in my career previously, where the letter was a bit of sharing about my own sort of personal sense of anguish and disappointment around, you know, what I saw around me, as well as sharing a bit of my personal story, and I share with our organization, you know, frankly, growing up in Tuskegee, Alabama, in a fairly segregated part of the country, and shared perspectives that I had growing up, but not really understanding, but having civil rights leaders sitting in the living room of our home in Tuskegee, Alabama, where I was born, and so I shared a little bit of that with our organization, and. But I'm also not one to sort of bellyache and sort of, wallow in my own sense of, of, you know, pity or doubt or whatever for very long. And so I pivoted to talking to our organization about, given our 100+ year history, we need to do more as an organization, and we need to spend time thinking about how do we impact the communities that we serve better than we've done in the past. And that anytime there's a challenge, the best thing to do is to use it as a rallying cry. And so let's use what we see around us as a rallying cry, and let's tap into the best of Henry Ford and the best of the 35,000 team members that we have. Thinking about how can we do more, and I can do more, not just from the top down, but also from the bottom up, and that we would engage the organization more to understand, their pain, their anguish, their frustration, you know, their sort of hopes for today and tomorrow. And we would really think through how we could elevate our work. That frankly, diversity, equity, inclusion were all very important parts of the fabric of our organization, but it wasn't enough, that we hadn't spent enough time talking about justice, and that we would add justice to our DEI strategy and plan. And so our plan would now adopt an explicit component around social justice. And that while we had done some things in the past to focus on justice, we likely hadn't played as broad a role in that as we could, and that there was heavy lifting to be done, you know, in and around Detroit and Southeast Michigan and the Midwest and other parts of the country, and that we shouldn't just pat ourselves on the back for the stuff we're doing around diversity, equity, inclusion inside our organization, you know, not unlike what Tim's colleague challenged him to do, but okay, so now what about outside your four walls? And so we began to sort of think, you know, and as a healthcare company, we do a lot of giving back to the community. I mean, our job is, you know, our mission isn't just to make money. Our mission is more about, you know, uplifting the community and improving community health than it is about making money. So that wasn't necessarily a challenge for us, but the notion of really talking broadly about social justice in ways that we had not before, and charging, you know, committee of the board and a set of senior leaders across the organization with support to really think about a justice initiative for Henry Ford Health System. And that's probably, you know, some of the biggest reaction that we had to last spring and summer.
And what I'm struck as I turn to Jenny is, you know, this past year has highlighted both the need for proactive, thoughtful planning and strategy, but also a clear recognition that there's times for crisis management as well around these topics, right? And so, Jenny, you know, an obvious question for those who've been paying attention, you know, one of your employees played a prominent role in highlighting racial tensions in America. So could you share a little bit about how you and Franklin Templeton responded and then what you've learned from that experience?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, I have to give a lot of credit to my team and, you know, sort of just pulling together the crisis management team. You know, this was a 3-day weekend and the incident happened. So we got everybody together. And I'm struck by Tim's comment about being a new, you know, CEO essentially. And so he's, you know, responding, well, I was pretty dang new CEO. And I actually thought about later when somebody said, well, you know, things are changing when a financial services CEO uses the word racism. And I thought, I didn't actually know I wasn't supposed to use the word racism, right? You know, so when we looked at that event and I think the team, you know, looked at it and I looked at it and we just felt like, you know, that we needed to act swiftly and call it what it was. Honestly, I think it was a little surprising to us that people were so surprised at how swiftly we responded, because, you know, we felt strongly about what it was. And look, you know, you could talk to 10 different lawyers and they'll all tell you your different risk level. And so that's where you have to come back and say, you got to believe in the heart of the firm. So we terminated the employee, and then it became an opportunity to actually have conversations internally. And so we've got, you know, I think 6 business resource groups. One was our Black Empowerment Network. And so I spent time talking to each of them. And it was interesting. The veterans had a different experience. But in talking to the Black Empower Network, one is I realized how much I needed to learn about the experience, right, of these folks. And I was really, my eyes were really opened. And I was so struck by some of the comments. And one thing in particular was the comment of, you know, it's kind of hard that people also are silent because they don't know what to say. It's so painful to us. They don't know what to say. And it struck me so much that I ended up doing a video in my, you know, I was dressed in my sweats and in my office, and I just addressed the whole company and said, you know, I was speaking to our Black Empowerment Network, and they realized that you know, they're grieving like at a funeral, and they know you don't know what to say, but they won't, you know, just reach out, and it's okay not to know. But we want them to know how much we care about them and that we recognize the pain that they're in. And so I think in these times, maybe you're taught as a leader that you have to be always confident and compartmentalizing and non-emotional and have the plan. And that the reality is sometimes the best thing is to listen and say, wow, I hear that you're in pain. And I think COVID maybe even opened up all CEOs to say, that's okay to have that be a part of your toolkit. So anyway, it was how I responded. Our view of what we needed to do was consistent with where social media had decided the incident happened. It's a lot harder to be a CEO and stand by your team when social media has gotten it wrong. And I've had two incidents, that one at Franklin, one not, and have had to address employees and say, look, we're standing by the employees that social media, you need to know that we're a firm that will stand by you if we think social media got it wrong. And that's much harder to do, frankly.
Yep. That makes a lot of sense to me. And clearly that incident in Central Park, which was, you know, which was live on social media and video, certainly was a call to action. I think you guys responded admirably, obviously, with sort of the way you did it, but also recognizing that there'd be a time to support and protect your employees. Tim, I'm going to turn back to you in last year. You know, clearly 3 years into this CEO action, I suspect you didn't hope that it would become such an important part of society, but it has. And it's also important that we should mention, not only is this a safe space, but also a place where allyship is really important. After the killing of George Floyd last year, you sent an email to your partners and employees asking them how they were doing and to start a company-wide conversation. I read that you were astonished with some of the feedback that you had received. So can you tell us a little bit about that incident, why you felt it was important to reach out, and then sort of the feedback and what you've learned from that?
Yeah, absolutely, Warren. If it's okay, I just want to come back to something that Jenny said first. For our listeners, I think the important point of there is no playbook. Like many, many people, when you get into the CEO roles, we get a lot of advisors, and we need advisors. We have great teams, and we're blessed with those teams. But the world is different, and going with humility and humanity is so important these days. And I find in my experience, sometimes people worry too much about the risk if we say the wrong thing, and we run the risk of just being careful and playing it safe. Like, people are too smart these days, like with social media, and there are no secrets. And so I'm encouraged by what I'll say, the level of authenticity that I've seen in leaders over the last couple of years. And it's growing and it's increasing. And that is where we see the way of the future. If we're going to maintain and grow trust with employees, with customers and communities, the type of leadership that Jenny and Wright are showing, and Jenny's point around when you're new, sometimes the naivety is actually helpful. Like, it's actually helpful to not have been like, I didn't know I was supposed to do that. I'll just tell you one of the quick story. Back in July 2016, I asked in front of a room of 500 people, I said, just be honest with you, how many are uncomfortable whether you're supposed to use the word Black or African-American? And literally half the room raised their hands. Like, that's how eggshell we were. Like half the room wasn't even sure whether they should use the word Black or African-American. Like, how are you going to get sophisticated if we can't make it out of the basics? And so I think sometimes that the naivety of, look, let's go on this journey together is hugely important. So now I'll come to George Floyd. So we all had our routines pre and post pandemic, right? So my routine in the pandemic is I'll get up very early, I'll go for a workout, and then I drive down to my local Dunkin' Donuts, which the New Englanders will appreciate. Jenny and Wright maybe less so, but the New Englanders will certainly appreciate it. And I get my coffee, and I actually sat in the parking lot, and I put my phone up on my dashboard, and I shot a video. Like, I just shot a video that I sent to our people, and I just said, like, my God, this is horrible. Like, this is horrible. And I can only imagine how you feel. And I want you to tell me how you feel. And I reminded people, we've been on the journey for 3 years around making it safe and talking about these issues. And thousands and thousands of emails came in from our people. And I do, I read every single one of it. I'm smiling when I say this, if you can't see me. I know whenever I send an email or a video like that, the next three nights I'm gonna be up all night, because I read everyone and I review it. And I'm okay doing that, because it is truly how you learn. What came across were two big things, Warren. One was our Black professionals were stunned and a little bit angry that so many of us were surprised. To them, George Floyd was a tragic, but they were surprised that we were surprised, because this was their reality, like in their communities, in their families, in their social circles. And yet we were surprised because it was captured by social media. So first there was this huge outcrying of, like, thank you for caring, thank you for asking, thank you for engaging, but please don't be surprised and think this is the only one. And that was a big theme. The other big theme was the more you do, the higher the bar gets raised. And there was a clear expectation, given the progress, and please don't mistake the word progress for perfection, because we have a long way to go. But there was a sense, we need to do more. We, given the leadership role, given where we are, given how upfront we've been on the issue. And it was more like, Tim, what are you going to do? Like, what's next? Like what we've been doing has been good, but what's more? And there was a really big theme around, we as an employee population, we want the ability to do more. And those were the two big themes. And then I'll close with this. We, like Wright, we wanted to make sure whatever we did was sustainable. I'm proud of how well the CEO community rallied when George Floyd happened. But a big thing we all got to guard against is not letting it become the seventh priority now, right? So right. One of the things we looked at is whatever we're going to do, how do we make it sustainable? And so our people raised the bar. We need to think about what was next.
And I'm going to turn to our member questions next. But before I do that, it's obvious, right, that you are nodding your head in responding to Tim's sort of statement and actions. And I was wondering if you'd like to weigh in on this.
Well, a couple of points. I think the issue around how people react to something like George Floyd, it's fascinating. His commentary about how do you sort of get sophistication in a conversation when you're not sure, how do you refer to a group and what are they comfortable with? And, the short answer is, well, there's not homogeneity in this. And so, like, there's not an answer. And so, one of the challenges is when I think I made a comment earlier, when people look at me and say, well, you're a Black leader or you're an African-American leader, so you should have all the answers, right? I mean, like, your company should be the best at this. And it's like, okay, well, thanks for giving me that sense of that vote of confidence, but not necessarily. And I think the issue around people being surprised or not, I mean, we've been lulled to some extent, our country has been lulled to sleep. I think people were lulled asleep by the election of Barack Obama. And so people sort of thought, oh, well, if the United States can elect a Black man twice, well, like, then, like, we're kind of done, aren't we? Like, there aren't any race issues left, because, you just elected a Black man for 8 years and, to the most powerful, role in the world. And to some extent, what I said to folks, and some folks have gotten really uncomfortable by me making this comment, but but you know, so it is what it, it's my point of view. So, you know, I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying it's what I believe. You know, I think to some extent, the election of Barack Obama, frankly, created created more tension, and some of what we're seeing today is sort of a backlash to that, because I think people were surprised that he was elected because parts of the country weren't ready for that, the same way parts of our society aren't ready for this conversation, the same way parts of society, parts of our companies, frankly, aren't comfortable with the stances that Jenny or Tim or I might take. You know, I sent a letter out to our organization in support of Asian and Pacific Islanders recently with all the violence that was happening. And to Tim's point, so I work really hard. I won't say that I read every single one, but I try my best to read every single response when I send those things out, because you get a lot of them. And I oftentimes recall the responses that are sort of in opposition or in conflict more than the ones that are giving me a pat on the back, to be honest with you. And so, because those always stand out to me, because I'm always thinking, okay, so now what do I learn from this? What do I learn from this? And I remember one person sent back a very curt, sort of terse message to me that said, the police report said that he didn't shoot those people because they were Asian. And you know, so part of you wants to engage that person in a debate around, okay, well, you didn't understand my point. It's not about the police report. It's about the fact that there are segments of our society that are in pain because other segments of our society are holding them, are treating them in a way that's less than we would want our kids to be treated. And so if that's happening, then isn't that important to all of us? And it kind of gets back to, you know, our goal as an organization, which is equity for all. And so when we talk about our social justice mission now, what we've defined is equity for all. And that's a pretty high bar. And we had a lot of discussion about that around the organization and at the board level around, well, how can Henry Ford commit to equity for all? Like, that's not in our power or in our control. And the answer is no, it's not. But that's the ideal that we stand for. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that we can do everything, but it means that we can do a lot to demonstrate our commitment to that. And so those were some of the reactions I was having just listening to Tim and just kind of thinking about the topic. So thanks for asking, Warren.
Well, and thanks for sharing. I think these are important conversations to have. And with that, I'm really pleased that we have an organization that has been so engaged in these topics over the past year and longer. I apologize. Apparently, Boston College is deciding to do some landscaping right now during the webinar, but that's fine. But I'm going to turn the microphone over to some of our members. And folks, the way we do this is we will unmute you. You'll have a chance to ask your question of the panel. First up will be Gerald Chertavian. He is the founder and CEO of Year Up. And Carol Fulp, you will be on deck. So, Gerald, with any luck, you've joined us and we can hear your question.
That's great. Thanks so much, Warren. Appreciate it. And thanks, Tim, Jenny, and Wright for the thoughtful discussion and comments today. It was really helpful. My question was, in your view, does it mean to become an anti-racist organization? And is this a goal to which your organizations have committed?
Anyone want to take that first? Jenny, you want to go?
Well, I mean, look, I think we would all like to say that we are an anti-racist organization. The problem is, and I think as you really start to understand the science around this bias, is, you know, there's an element of the fight and flight that has a reaction to people that you haven't had as much exposure to, right? So I actually look at this as a journey that you're continuing to always improve. And by the way, you know, as a global organization, we have to focus on discrimination that looks different in different regions of the world. So it's about sort of a groups that are somehow underrepresented. Again, it's access and opportunity. And for whatever reason, they aren't experiencing that as at the same level. And you know, it's about constantly listening to understand what people's experiences are. It's about the language. I mean, Tim, you know, I laugh when you say the Black versus African American. because I intentionally asked our D&I person in front of the executive committee, hey, do you say Black or African-American? And she said, and she's a Black woman. And she said, well, you know, it's a generational thing. And then she came to me later. She said, actually, Jenny, I had to go back and look at the history. And about every generation, they kind of come up with a new term, right? And then she said, and I wasn't sure right now if for LGBTQ, I should use the word queer or not. And I can tell you my generation, queer would have been derogatory. Now it's actually the term that you use, right? So all those things are part of, the most important is an organization that is committed to listening and constantly trying to improve and not being afraid of measuring, not being afraid of putting out, you know, public metrics around this, and to always understand what people's experiences are and try to be empathetic. And so that would be my thoughts on it.
Tim or Wright, either of you want to give it a shot?
Yeah, I'll go if it's okay, Wright. Absolutely, our goal is to not be a racist organization. And one of our goals and my personal goals is I want us to be the most inclusive lodge organization in the world. And that's our goal. And my team and I talk about that all the time in terms of how we do that. In terms of ways that we're trying to go about that, we have been relentless since 2016. And PwC was on a 25-year journey prior to that. And we are talking about it all the time. Like it is part of our DNA, part of our fiber in terms of who we are. Now I'll intersect with Wright's point. Whenever I send out an email that goes to our values or what's happening, it probably a unofficial count. It's a ratio of 10 to 20 to 1. Meaning 10 to 20 are pats in the back, and one is like, you know, here's an alternative view. I read the police report. Did you study it? Here's what the data says. This is wrong. You're missing the other side of point of view. I read every one of those, and oftentimes I'll reach out and talk to those people. And I'll reach out, and the video has made that a heck of a lot easier to do that. And every time I speak with someone who starts out having an opposing point of view, I learn more. I learn how to communicate differently, how to listen. And I want to watch Time Warren, but if I can tell a quick story. After we went live with our data, to Jenny's point, we became the most transparent lodge organization that we are aware of in the United States on August 26. We put out a transparency report, and it's on our website, and we benchmarked against all of the lodge companies, and our goal was to show more than any other company. And we disclosed 14 specific metrics of where we are. After we issued that, that was 3 years in the making. We were thrilled. We were excited to do that. We talked about it on our staff webcast that day when we did it. And I got an angry email. It read angry from a young man who had been with us for 10 years. And I replied, I'd love to talk to you. And I listened to his story, and we met over video, and he opened up and he started to tear up. And he said, Tim, he said, I grew up in Michigan, dirt poor. My mother was a single parent. She had three jobs, and her third job was cleaning the cafeteria at lunch at my school. And I had to watch my friends make fun of me. He said, Tim, I never could afford dental insurance until I started working at PwC. And he said, I'm white, and I feel like at times I don't belong here because people don't understand me and I don't fit in. I got to tell you, for me, it was eye-opening. Because racist goes a heck of a long way, and it means different things to different people. My goal is, by listening to people, you can help create an environment where everybody feels like they're belonging. And it's a constant adjustment. Like Jenny says, journey, I agree with that. To me, it's like you're tweaking and adjusting all the time. Sometimes they're big tweaks, sometimes they're small tweaks, but you're constantly adjusting. And frankly, I've learned not to get angry when I read that angry email, but instead reach out and learn. And it has been massively helpful for me to do that.
You know, I would, Warren, I just add a couple points to Tim's last comment. You know, I would just say that when you're working on this path, sometimes you feel like no good deed goes unpunished. And so I appreciate Tim's comment about how he's trying to learn. To the questioner and the issue around committing to an anti-racist organization, you know, I would just say that you know, our diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice strategic plan as we define it, just talking about equity for all, we've defined four key pillars. And the pillar that got the most conversation and the most controversy was the first one. And it was the pillar around anti-racism and social justice. And in that pillar, we wrote, and I quote, "We commit to rejecting all forms of bias, racism, and violence within our organization and our communities." And so no one had a problem with committing to work on it. No one had a problem with committing to speak up against it. But as we said, we commit to eliminating all forms. You know, a lot of folks said, "We just can't do that. Well, this is not possible." And you know, Jenny used the word journey. And every time we talk about this, we talk about our journey to equity for all. And so the notion being that you never start a race at the finish line. You start a race at the starting line. And what you're looking for is progress. And what you're looking for is to see that you've moved from the starting line closer towards the finish line. And this is one of those areas where, you know, the reality is we will not get to the finish line. Or certainly not in my lifetime, we will not get to the finish line. And that's okay. And I think that sometimes in organizations, we get so committed to creating goals that you accomplish and then you move on to the next thing, that this is not one of those times. This is a time where you're on a journey and you commit to making progress. And at times you're going to commit to having missteps and moving backwards, or you're going to commit to things happening that are absolutely inconsistent with what you as a CEO of a company expect, desire, want for your organization, and you regroup and you take a step backwards and hopefully take two steps forward the next time. So I'll stop with that.
No, and I think that's worth underscoring. And I think it's a perfect segue to our next question with both you and Tim and Jenny, to some extent as well, talking about the importance of everyone feeling like they belong. Our next question comes from Carol Fulp, who is the founder and CEO of Fulp Diversity. She's also written a book, Success Through Diversity, Why the Most Inclusive Companies Will Win. Buy it now on Amazon and everywhere else. But Carol, I'm going to turn the microphone over to you to hopefully ask a question that might challenge what we're all doing and what else we can do to make the world better here based on some of the events that are happening this month.
Thank you so much, Warren, and thank you to our guests. This has been such an enlightening and inspiring conversation, particularly as we go through the trial of Derek Chauvin. It's just such a healthy conversation to have. But as we talked about going backward, I wanted to get the panelists' thoughts about the New York Times full page ad where 72 Black executives led by Ken Chenault and Ken Frazier, who Warren, you've had as speakers and and several others, Tony Coles, Benny and Flash Wiley signed this letter calling upon corporate America to really vigorously oppose voter suppression. What is the CEO Council doing to assist in this regard? It's about this social justice issue that Wright talked about, but what is being done and what can we do to help support these efforts, because as you've talked about, we can't afford to go backwards.
Yep, Warren, it's Tim. Why don't I take that, if that's okay, Carol? Thank you so much for your question and for your work. It's greatly appreciated. So a couple of things. When we formed CEO Action back in 2017, so coming up in the 4-year anniversary, the original intent was to help companies get better with inside their four walls. When George Floyd's killing happened, we heard from not only thousands of our people, but we also heard from hundreds of other companies, and keep in mind there was 2,000, but we heard from hundreds that they wanted to do more. Now, all 2,000, to be very frank, were not up for more, but a couple of hundred were up to do more. And so we formed an umbrella, think of it as a subsidiary of CEO Action, called CEO Action for Racial Equity. And we formed that group together, and we ideated over the summertime, this past summer, and we officially launched the group in the fall of this past year. And that group today, it consists of over 300 people from 125 companies. That group's mission is to work on public policy to end systemic racism. And what we did is we invited every company to contribute one or more people for a two-year fellowship to work full-time as a startup organization under the umbrella CEO Action for Racial Equity to end systemic racism and to focus on four critical areas: public safety, public health, education, and financial equity. That group was onboarded the first week in October, and that group has been working for the last 4 or 5 months on identifying policy areas at the city, state, and federal level to find ways to work together, the business community and public policymakers, to do this. And we just, by coincidence, early last week did our first press release of the first policy areas that we're working on. We've been partnering and working with places like Brookings, places like BRT, and many others. Given the voter issues and the voter suppression that you point out, specifically your question, last week we issued a statement. We've talked to the leaders that you mentioned, and we're now working together to find more ways this group can lean into the public policy matter on voter suppression as well. So that's underway. But the big thing that we did is business needs to weigh in more on public policy than we have in the past. Again, to be very candid, some are more comfortable than others doing that. But I'm very proud to let you know we've got a group of 125 companies, and we're proud to have issued a statement last week standing against the voter suppression that's out there. I hope that helps, Carol. And I'm happy to talk more if you desire.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you.
Yep.
Jenny Wright, any response to that, or shall I move on to the next question?
Well, I would just say really quickly, you know, we're proud to have contributed a fellow to that, to the initiative that Tim just spoke about. And, you know, in general, would just say that, you know, we're a country built on democracy. And, you know, the goal should be that everyone's voice should be heard, irrespective of, you know, what direction they might decide to cast a vote for. And so, you know, I'm strongly in favor of ensuring that we have, you know, policies and procedures and laws and regulations that allows everyone's voice to be heard in an unfettered manner. So I appreciate the work, obviously, that Tim just described, and we're happy to support it.
Yeah, and I apologize for the sigh, but recognition that we actually have to state that in 2021. But obviously, I applaud that statement. Jenny?
Yeah, no, look, this country is built on the belief that everybody has an equal vote, right? I mean, so free and fair elections are paramount to, I think, our society, and we've got to just ensure that people have good access and to the woman who asked the question, she's absolutely right. I mean, companies can make a big difference. My family's involved in MLB. My brother's a controlling partner of the San Francisco Giants. They pulled out of the All-Star game. I mean, it makes a difference, right? You know, the statements are, you know, that corporations can really make a difference.
Yeah, I couldn't underscore that more, and I agree with you on you know, keeping an eye on what's happening around the industries in terms of how baseball responded with a swift response unexpectedly with Rob Manfred, who joined us about a year and a half ago as well. So I'm rather than going to the lightning round of questions right now, this is a topic that's too important to launch into asking each of you what your favorite food is and first paying job, although, you know, maybe we'll get to those. We will return to a message of hope at the end from each of you, but I'm going to turn. We have another question from Rich Holbrook. Rich has been around and been the CEO of a bank, involved with the Federal Reserve here in Boston. Richard, hopefully we can turn your microphone on and you have a chance to ask your question of our panel.
Thank you, Warren. You know, at Eastern Bank, where I was CEO for many years, we had a long tradition of supporting a number of social justice issues. And under our current CEO, Bob Rivers, we've taken that even further. We're very proud of that. But every time we've made statements in the press or done things, we always get, I would say, overwhelming support for what we do. But there's always a minority of customers, sometimes colleagues, but almost particularly among customers, who respond negatively to our efforts and wonder why we're doing this. Why are we not just doing our basic banking business? Why do we get involved with this? And so my question to you is, how do you respond to your customers, your clients, your shareholders, when you have a negative response from them in response to your efforts to try and improve diversity and inclusion or any social justice issue?
You know, I'll take a shot at that. You know, when we responded on the issue in Central Park, we had about 90% of the folks were very supportive of our decision, about 10% really vehemently against kind of the view. And, you know, you're never going to get it 100% right. And so we're looking at it and saying, you know, it isn't black and white. We have to take a stand on what we believe is right as a leader. I have to take a stand. My team has to take a stand. And you're never going to please everybody. But if you try to please everybody, you're never going to get anything done. We just look at it and say, number one, having a diverse, at our core, we believe having a diverse employee base is going to give us better outcomes because they're going to bring examples in that if everybody's thinking alike, and I always say, let's face it, we love talking to people who agree with us. That's why social media is becoming so polarized. I mean, when I talk to people who agree with me, I think I'm really smart. Right. And it's so much work to have to talk to somebody who doesn't agree with me. So, you know, it's easy to do that part. What's hard is actually to create that diverse environment where you actually have to work through differing views, but you know you're going to get better outcomes. So we believe fundamentally at our core that having that diverse employee base is going to be more work, but is going to be better for us. Number two, we believe that in deploying capital, that there's going to be, just by the fact that we acknowledge people have bias, that there's going to be great investment opportunities if we can change the screen and how we're thinking about deploying capital because others won't be there. And so that's a great business opportunity for us. So then I think, you know, the other thing that we focus on is just supplier networks and trying to be more broad in the diversity of our supplier networks for all the reasons that we believe it's good for our employees and deployment of capital. We think we're going to get better supplier partners if we have a more diverse group. Nothing in life. I think we all, you don't get to be CEO if you're afraid of, you know, having people disagree with you. That's just kind of part of the game, I think.
Yeah, Warren, it's Tim. And if I can build off of Jenny, I agree. And I was just smiling, Jenny, as you were saying that. Rich, and to you and Bob, thank you for the leadership as a Bostonian. I really appreciate it. I would add to what Jenny says. One of my hopes is over time, a big part of the role we can all play is education and awareness. What I've found is the word journey applies here as well. And I agree, there's the 90-10, 80-20 that, you know, we're never going to get everybody happy. And I'm fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with David Taylor. I mean, Procter & Gamble has been out in front of educating about women and about African Americans on a regular basis. And there's that 20%. One of the things that I would encourage and happy to talk offline is educating why. Like the fact is the not only the right thing to do, but the economic prosperity we can all enjoy if we lift our society to equality, it does truly benefit everybody. A growth story doesn't benefit when we get more jobs, we get equal pay. But that's over time. Like that's a deliberate approach over time. And with social media, with digital, that can be used in ways that never it was before, we have an opportunity. One of my dreams before I finish my CEO tenure is to have colleges, universities teach diversity inclusion courses that starts with data, just data, like what the facts are and what the opportunity is, what how you lead and what measurement is. And I do think there's an opportunity for all of us to educate so many people along the way as to why we're doing this, because unfortunately many take it as polarizing and we're doing this. I think there's a big heart, but there's a big head here as well. If we lift so many communities out of poverty, we're all going to win in terms of going forward. And I think there's a big role we can play in terms of educating customers as to why we're doing it. some small percentage may view that this is political, as opposed to this is a huge societal opportunity, but it takes time.
And Wright, I'll turn to you and Tim from just so you know, the Carroll School of Management here at Boston College has brought Carol Fulpin in along with other leaders to talk about these issues here with our business students, both graduate and undergraduate. So I'm sure that she and I are taking copious notes. We'll look forward to a full syllabus with the three of us and Carol joining us in the fall semester. So be prepared to join us, hopefully in person, but at least virtually. The pay is nothing, but it's a great chance to engage in lifelong learning on behalf of Boston College. So with that, right, I'll turn it back over to you.
I love it. I don't know that I have a lot more to add to Richard's question, other than because I think that Jenny and Tim did a really great job. You know, I guess I would always just say that it's always right when to do the right thing. And I think that businesses prosper when businesses do the right thing. Now, you know, I don't have either the luxury, the blessing, or the curse of running a publicly traded company. So I don't have to necessarily worry about, the New York Stock Exchange and investors and shareholders from that perspective. But I have a lot of stakeholders, and, you know, our company touches 2 million people a year, and we operate principally across the state of Michigan, where there's varying points of view about life in the world. And so, you know, there are times where some of the points of view we might have may not play as well in some parts of the state as other parts, because there may be differing views. You know, we have some parts of states that are more liberal or more conservative or more moderate. And so there's some who will say, hey, you know, that seems like, you know, the moderate parts of the state might say, hey, that's a little risky. Like, why are you doing that? Or the, you know, more liberal parts of state might say, you guys should go even further. So, you know, I think to Jenny's point, when you sit in this chair, you know that people will have perspectives about what you do. But I just generally believe that there's never, it's never wrong for your business to do the right thing. And this topic is clearly the right thing. And so it's going to pay in both a workforce that is more engaged and more willing to put forth their 110% to help you do what you have to do as a business. And I think that the vast majority of our customers and stakeholders will believe that doing the right thing is right for business. So.
Well, thanks, Wright. And I there's times I can't believe that we have to say some of the things we say, but I'm glad that we're saying them, if that makes sense. I think the most important role of my job as a moderator is to make sure that we start and end on time. We've got 7 minutes left for our scheduled 1:15 unplugging. But I do want to turn to the last question. So keep that in mind as you answer. Each time I've done this for the past 14 months, I've asked each of our guests to give us a message of hope. Something our members can leave this conversation with today, with something positive to think back on and to put them in the right frame of mind moving forward. Jenny, I will come to you first for your brief message of hope for us, and then Wright and Tim, you're up.
You know, I you don't improve unless you first acknowledge where you are. And I actually think that painful as this year has been, with all the incidences that happened, you know, this stuff has been going on, and most of us were pretty unaware of it. And so I would say the fact that it is now in our face, and by the way, nobody's actions are going to be anonymous any longer, right? Everything is recorded. And so I go to this small town in Montana. Nobody cuts anybody off. You're very polite in the grocery store. Why? Because you're going to see the person in church, or you're going to see him at the school parent meeting, right? So I actually think that the fact that you can't be anonymous any longer is actually going to make people accountable for their actions. And that in itself will start to have improvement. So out of this incredibly painful year, we're going to find that we're going to be accountable. Companies are accountable. Individuals are accountable. And therefore, we're going to see great improvement towards this.
Accountability leads to improvement, right?
Yes.
Excellent. Right, you're up.
So Warren, as you and I talked before, you know, my undergraduate degree came from a Jesuit school, and I have a a minor in philosophy. So I'll end with this. There's an English theologian who coined the phrase that we oftentimes use, that it's always darkest before the dawn. And so I think that it's when we get concerned about how desperate our current plight is, maybe it's time for us to remember that phrase, that it's always darkest before the dawn, and that, you know, things always seem to be at their most dire before they get better. And so we've had an extremely challenging year with obviously a global pandemic and all of the issues around race and social unrest and social justice challenges over the last year or so, that are trying us, that are testing us, that are testing our resolve, that maybe are testing our sense of, are we who we thought we were? And I think the short answer is, you know, you should never bet against the human condition and the goodness that are in people. And I believe strongly that that this dark period will be transformed into a period that's pretty amazing. Not without effort, not without sweat, not without some, you know, blood, sweat, and tears, but we will come out of it. So.
Excellent. That's a positive message, and something drawing upon that your Jesuit education is always valued here at Boston College. But
I know.
Tim, I started my first question of the day to you. I will end our last question with you as well. The person who brought us all together, who created the CO Action, give us your message of hope.
Yeah, Warren, let me thank, first of all, you, and I want to thank very much Jenny and Wright for your leadership and partnership, and the fact that we can come together gives me a lot of hope. For your listeners, I grew up in Boston. I grew up in High Park in Dedham. My family didn't have a lot at all. I've had the privilege to work in the PwC. I've been to 61 countries, and up until a year ago, I would have been a road warrior 100%. I've seen almost every major country in the world, and for all of our wards, we are by far and away the best country in the world. We're a democracy. You can speak your mind. We have incredible people. We have incredible educational institutions, and we are a place where, given choice, most people in the world would want to be. And I'm very optimistic on our country, and I could not agree more with Wright. When you're in your darkest times, it's when this country is at its best. Jenny talked about accountability, and I'm going to extend that to transparency. We live in the golden age of transparency, and that is good. There are no secrets. The four walls of our companies go out to our countries, and the harder we work at our stories, the better we'll be. And that transparency and accountability will make us better and better. And I'm seeing that. I am so inspired and encouraged by where the business community has gone over the last 4 years. I don't know about you all, but as using that athletic analogy, since I'm with Boston College, the best people want the ball when the times are the hardest. And the game's on the line. Like, the game's on the line. Like, the next 4 or 5 years are going to define what we are. And I'm confident in the CEO community. They want the ball. And I think the business community can really, really make a difference. And I'm seeing that. I have the privilege of going to dozens of companies on a monthly basis, and what they're doing is remarkable. I'll close with my hope here. Yesterday, we're sitting at the dinner table. My 15-year-old daughter, who has a number of special needs, she asked me if next weekend we can watch the Harriet Tubman movie. And that, for me, told me we're making progress, because I can't wait to sit down. And that's what she wants to talk about. And I can't wait. So thank you for having me.
That's fantastic. That's a great story and a great way to wrap up what I found as to be an absolutely fascinating and interesting and enjoyable conversation on an important topic that we face as citizens of the world, but certainly for our members who are CEOs in leadership positions, where they have a chance to actually execute and make a difference. On behalf of Boston College, clearly, we're thrilled that Jenny Wright and Tim, that you joined us today for this conversation. Looking for the future, just so folks know, mark your calendars. We have two events coming up. On May 25th, we will be joined by the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, the Honorable Kimberly Budd. She'll be joining us then. And then we heard his name earlier. I'm announcing now, on June 22nd, our pandemic series conversations with CEOs started with Dr. Tony Coles, the CEO of Humanity Therapeutics and Cerevel Therapeutics, and all sorts of other interesting things. He's going to join us on June 22nd to sort of, I don't want to say have a wrap up and put a pin in this, but to see what we've learned over the past 14 months. But again, on behalf of Boston College, our members, the Carroll School of Management, Jenny, Tim, Wright, thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful day and stay in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you very thank you much. More. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Take
you
care, Tim. Take care, Jenny. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club, featuring PwC's CEO Action for Diversity and Inclusion Initiative, with Jenny Johnson, President and CEO of Franklin Templeton, Wright Lassiter III, President and CEO of the Henry Ford Health System, and Tim Ryan, U.S. Chairman and Senior Partner of PwC. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.